Just remember what old Jack Burton does when the earth quakes and the poison arrows fall from the sky and the pillars of heaven shake. Yeah, Jack Burton just looks that big old storm right square in the eye and he says, "Give me your best shot, pal. I can take it."
So you do want to watch Ghost Dad?
I can take it.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema, the only podcast rated triple X by the American Heart Association. This is the Film School Rejects weekly cult exploitation film podcast that will stuff your face with schlock without filling you up on irony. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and there's still nothing we can do about that. And I am joined by my co-host and cohort,
Ghost Dad.
Ghost Dad himself, Bill Cosby, ladies and gentlemen.
You see, this gizm, this gazmops, he's gazm with a junk food cinema, you see.
I don't think you worked out all the kinks in the Leonard parts 1 through 5, but actually it's C. Robert Cargill.
Yeah, hey. Hi, everybody.
Who was much more excited when he was Bill Cosby, apparently.
I really was. Yeah, you had me thinking we were going to talk about Ghost Dad today. You got me all excited, and instead we're talking about some movie that nobody's seen.
Some movie that no one has heard of, and we'll get to that in just a second. Just want to remind you guys that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also find us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. We'd appreciate your likes and your follows.
And the Ghost Dad fan forum.
And the Ghost Dad fan forum, which is a thing that probably exists out there if you really want to go search for it. Actually, I'm demanding that you go search for it. I really want to know if it exists. Maybe it's like the Space Jam website that still exists.
You know what? I'm really kind of terrified of that notion. All of a sudden, I'm thinking, you know, if that does exist, you know what also exists?
What?
Rule 34 kicks in.
We get
Ghost Fan, Ghost Dad fanfic.
I keep saying no. You keep going, and I just like, please stop. Which is also what the Ghost Dad fanfic is called. Anyway, that's not what we're talking about today. We are continuing on our first ever curated series here on Junk Food Cinema, all about sci-fi comedies in honor of Guardians of the Galaxy. And today's film is one of my absolute favorites, John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China.
Jack Burton's coming to rescue your summer.
Hey, what more can a guy ask for?
I think we went maybe 4 weeks without talking about a John Carpenter movie, so I was getting a little antsy. I was starting to get the shakes a bit. So
you were.
So I'm glad
Carpenter is essentially Junk Food Cinema Spielberg.
Yes.
You know, if Roger Corman is our Jerry Bruckheimer, then Carpenter is our Spielberg.
Yeah.
You know, he did the lower budget awesomer films.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, this was written by W.D. Richter, who directed last week's Buckaroo Banzai. And you know what? I'm really upset that we didn't talk about this film when we did our urban fantasy show, because revisiting it, I realized, oh shit, that would actually have qualified as urban fantasy as well.
It does.
It exists in so many spheres at the same time.
It was one of those things we had considered, but this was one of those movies that it's really on the bubble for film geeks. And it really is one of those things that is it too big to talk about?
Is it
one of those films that is so well known that it doesn't quite qualify for this? But then, you know, in talking to a number of young fans, some of these movies are things that we consider to be classics,
mm-hmm.
but are classics in the same way that our generation knew that movies like High Noon were classics to the generation that came before us. And we had never watched them until we were older.
Well, and it's also the fact that, you know, when you talk about Big Trouble in Little China, it is one of the quintessential cult classic films, meaning that when it first came out, mainstream audiences didn't know what to do with it. It was a financial bomb.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until later that audiences started to discover kind of the brilliance of it. And I think it qualifies, you know, there is something to be said for, you know, our show, what we like to do a lot of times is introduce people to films they might not have seen. But, you know, we have to keep in mind, like you said, like the younger generation of burgeoning film geeks have to be told at some point that Big Trouble in Little China exists.
Yeah.
You're not born with the innate ability. Well, if you had my father, you were kind of born knowing about John Carpenter because there was no other way that you could live. But you know, for the most part, people, they'll go after like the really big cult classics. They'll go after like the Rocky Horrors, and they'll go after, you know, the films that are legendary for their cult status. But Big Trouble in Little China, I feel like is, you know, like you said, it's on the bubble. But I feel like it's a film that definitely in all ways qualifies for what this show is and what we're all about.
Well, and I when you mentioned it, you didn't actually pitch it to me as being, you know, a curated thing. We had talked for a while about possibly doing a theme month.
Yeah.
And then you sent me this list of sci-fi comedies, and I just looked at it and said, oh yeah. This is all because of Guardians of the Galaxy. This is all sci-fi comedies. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I sent you back the list of other ones. But this is one on your list. And when I saw this and Buckaroo Banzai together, I'm like, oh yeah, he's totally on this Guardians of the Galaxy trip. And that's where I suggested a couple other ones that had similar, looks or feel, or themes. And then we narrowed it down to this list. And this is one of those films that I think really kind of, really captures best out of this list what Guardians of the Galaxy was, mm-hmm. what, you know, and was trying to be, in that it is, hey, let's take this very serious kind of mythology, this very serious material, and let's make a comedy about it by explaining it to the audience through an everyman character.
And you mentioned High Noon, and I'm so glad that you did, because the first thing I want to talk about when we talk about Big Trouble in Little China is the fact that it was, and as you know, fans of this movie probably already know this, it was conceived as a Western. The original idea is that it would be Jack Burton's horse, not his semi-truck, that would be stolen by the warring factions. And if you notice, in the alleyway fight at the beginning of the film, all the good guys are wearing white and all the bad guys are wearing black, which is, of course, a classic demarcation of good and evil carried over from the cinematic tropes of the Western with the black hats and the white hats. And then it also might explain why Kurt Russell is doing his John Wayne impression here, whereas he did a Clint Eastwood impersonation for Escape from New York. So he's effectively therefore covered the whole gamut of Western hero archetypes. But what you may not know is that it wasn't John Carpenter's decision to change it to a modern day story, to an urban fantasy. It was actually W.D. Richter's decision. And his reasoning was a little off the wall. His reasoning was, as paltry as it is, well, Rosemary's Baby was set in modern day and look how well it did. Because if there are two films that are very similar in no way whatsoever, it is Rosemary's Baby and Big Trouble in Little China.
Well, I get the feeling. Okay, so
that was his whole, and then Carpenter was just like, "Well, you're the screenwriter, so okay."
Richter's screenplay, and we'll go more into the in depth into this later. This is one of those brilliant example screenplays in which it does almost everything perfectly, so perfectly that you don't see what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. That it just looks like fun.
Yeah. And that there's only a few tiny missteps and they're common pitfalls of Hollywood films, especially Hollywood films of this era. But that so much of what Richter did was so smart. And one of the smartest things about it is we are exposing American audiences of the 1980s to Asian mysticism, mm-hmm. and mythologies that they're completely unfamiliar with. And how do we do that? Mm-hmm. We've got this perfect everyman by which we get to follow through the film. He's a guy who's a likable idiot.
Yes.
And we get to learn everything through him. Mm-hmm. So let's make this movie set in it as mundane a setting as possible so that the fantastic seems incredibly fantastic and explainable. If you set it in the Old West, this movie, I don't think this movie would have worked as a Western. I think it would have just been too fucking weird. It would have been another Buckaroo Banzai. And I don't.
Yes, because that didn't work at all.
Not for audiences at the time.
Neither did this film. No, I mean, arguably.
No, I'm saying this is a movie we would watch now. You know, some of us would, but we would just be like, man, this movie's fucking weird. Whereas now you don't sit there watching this movie going, man, this movie's weird. You watch it going, this movie's just good.
I mean, I still think it's pretty fucking weird, but I don't think that detracts from how good it is. But I want to,
but it's not absurd in the way the Buckaroo Banzai is.
It's not quite as absurd as Buckaroo Banzai, but I mean, it didn't work for audiences at the time, much like Buckaroo Banzai didn't. And we've, you know, I mean, I think we have to take this, like, this weird alpha film consumer that we, this group that we fall into, out of the conversation entirely when we start thinking about this, because you and I, believe it or not, are not normal.
No, I know this. but I was simply referring to, you know, because Buckaroo Banzai is a movie where, as much as we love it, it's still a movie that you sit back and go, fuck, this movie's kind of fucking weird. Mm-hmm. And there are moments that, even as well as you know the movie, you're just kind of reveling in just how absurd it is. And that's never your experience with Big Trouble. Big Trouble is a movie that and this is what I'm getting at, is W.D. Richter did such a brilliant job here of just setting you in this universe that you just buy it as you go along, and you're just along for the ride. And it's brilliantly constructed in that way that by the time you walk out of that movie for the first time, you're like, oh yeah, I totally understand the mechanics of how that was working.
Yeah.
I get that. Even as thinly drawn as some of the, you know, the mysticism is, and as wacky as it gets and its monsters are, it just works. Mm-hmm. And it is, you can feel like you're in that universe, whereas in Buckaroo Banzai, you never ever feel like you're really in Buckaroo Banzai's universe. You feel like you're watching a farce.
Yeah.
And that's not how this feels. And that's what I was referring to, was this is a much more accessible film for people. You could show this to your mom and dad. You could show this to kids of this generation and they get the film. Whereas Buckaroo Banzai, it takes, you know, that my wife was sitting there the whole time going, I love this, but it's fucking weird.
Yeah. Well, again, I'd have to take my dad out of the equation too.
Well, yes, but your dad is also one of us. One of us.
I want to talk about Jack Burton for a second. I don't think it's terribly I don't think it's terribly hyperbolic to note that Burton is one of the greatest male figures in cinema history. I mean, the broad, sweaty swagger, which is actually very authentic because Russell had the flu during part of the shoot, so that perspiration isn't just some moisture makeup that they dabbled on. It's genuine man sweat. But what's great about Kurt Russell, and the reason he is so perfect for this role, what he brings to the role is that he's, you know, for all of... Is a perfect mullet. And for all of Jack's uber macho blustering, Russell isn't afraid of letting the character look foolish in times of comedic hubris. So he's like, you know, he's got this, like, this is what Jack Burton does. I'm talking in third person. I've got all the, like, just swaggering machismo of John Wayne.
And a man would have to be some kind of fool to think we're all alone in this universe.
And then at certain times, like, he's got Gracie Law's lipstick all over his face, or he can't figure out how to make the gun fire, or he's portraying as part of a ruse a nearly virginal businessman in the brothel, by the way, wearing the same costume in that scene that he wore in Used Cars. That's a little piece of trivia from Big Trouble in Little China. But it's like he's not afraid to let that character be the buffoon.
Yeah.
And that's why the movie works. And he plays it so well. He plays that mix so well of a guy who is so full of himself that you still can't help but love, because at any given point, he'll be the buffoon.
And the thing is that it is the classic archetype that has drawn from this. And it's Jack Burton was very much drawn from, you know, the recently passed James Garner.
Hmm.
You know, James Garner kind of made the invented the everyman action hero in his early work in television and then later in movies. And Jack Burton is definitely he's cut from that cloth. He borrows from it. But then he does what many other action heroes don't and gives back in a way that he cemented this notion of the buffoonish everyman whose good intentions really do drive home his heroism. And so Jack Burton, by being hilarious, makes him more accessible, to use that term again, for us to love him while he's going off and doing these amazing things that you just don't know that he's capable of. But he's
he doesn't know he's capable of,
but he's capable of because of the power of his spirit and the power of his good intentions.
Yeah.
But man, his one-liners are the best part of this movie.
The dialogue, the script, the dialogue that Richter gives us is like the heart and soul of this movie. And it flows so well. And the conversations between between Jack and Dennis Dunn, who plays Wang, who's sort of, which funny enough, is the real hero of this movie.
Oh, yes.
Is the actual hero of the film.
Yeah, Jack Burton's the sidekick.
Jack Burton is the sidekick.
Yeah, but he becomes the hero because he's our access point through the movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, their dialogue, I mean, my second favorite line from the movie is easily, you can't go in there. No, I can, I'm ready. My spirit and body are one. There as two, I told you, I'm going with you. You know, that buffoonery, that foolishness of he has no idea what he's talking about, but he's talking about it anyway. And it's just so deadpan, and it's done so wonderfully.
Yeah,
and
the quips, man, the Jack Burton quips. You could write a philosophy book. It's almost like Zen and the Art of Jack Burton. Like you could write a philosophy book and just fill it with the one-liners that Jack Burton gives us.
You look him right in the eye and you say, "Have I paid my dues?"
Yes, sir. That check's in the mail. Yeah. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. That's the thing. It's like, for all of its weirdness, for all of the crazy places it goes, for all of the silly moments, it is a really airtight script. Like, it's a really well-constructed piece of screenwriting.
Well, and that's one of the things that's really impressive about this is how W.D. Richter takes this really hard to grasp and really hard to wrap your mind around mythology, at the time at least.
Mm-hmm.
And grounds it in a way that we can understand, but also sets up almost everything in the movie for wonderful payoff.
Right.
You know, here we are in this opening sequence, and Jack Burton has just finished a night of gambling with Wang. And Wang is like, "I'm going to cut this bottle and I'm going to cut it in half." He goes, he hits it. It doesn't, you anticipate that it's going to work. And it's like, oh, it's going to be Chinese mysticism and Burton's going to be screwed. No, it's the other way around. It's the perfect setup. He's doing multiple things in this scene in which he's setting up why Jack Burton is going to follow around Wang and get caught up in this whole kind of madness.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they're also setting up the final sequences with Jack Burton, and it's all in the reflexes.
Yes.
And he's already set up that line,
yeah,
you know, while driving just a few minutes before. And so when he catches it, you're already set up for it's all in the reflexes. It's like, oh, he's got great reflexes. And then it happens a couple other times. So finally, at the end of the movie, when the knife gets thrown at his head and he just catches it and throws it back, you're not like, how the fuck did he do that? You're like, instantly you're sitting there going, it's all in the reflexes.
But it is a good reminder. It is good that scene exists. And again, credit to Richter's screenplay, because otherwise we see him not be able to figure out how to turn the safety off on a gun.
Yeah.
So had we not had that scene with the bottle, you would be like, how the fuck would he possibly be able to do that?
No, you know? But the entire script is filled with those moments where they do such a great job of setting things up well in advance, but disguising them in scenes where it's doing something else.
Yeah.
And you know, that's, you don't think about the thing with the bottle, you think that's a little character quirk while you're watching this scene of how Jack Burton gets hooked into the story.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is setting up the ending at the same time. So they're setting up the beginning and the ending with the same wonderful character moment between mm-hmm. two guys where we learn what kind of friends these are.
Yeah. And then the whole time you're watching this movie, you've got a martial arts film, you've got a ghost story, you've got a Western for all intents and purposes.
You've got, again, a pulp comedy.
You've got a pulp comedy, you've got an urban fantasy, you've got all of these things going on at once. And what I love about it is this was the period of time where John Carpenter was really, really experimenting and doing a lot of different things. He was adapting Stephen King. He was making a touching sci-fi movie that was more in line with something like E.T. than it was with Alien. He went on to make a movie about an alien invasion that was all about Reaganomics. I mean, he was really like going out there and putting himself on a limb and trying new things and coming up with some of the best films, in my opinion, of his career.
Well, and that's where the the thing is this is past the line of demarcation. This is post Starman. Mm-hmm. And Starman was kind of the turning point in his career where he started into a decline. His films were not, did not become nearly the classics, although we love them. You know, there's two particular movies that he made in that period, three movies that he made that film geeks love, but that most, people snubbed. You know, this was one of them, Prince of Darkness. And then of course, In the Mouth of Madness. But yeah, he was playing around. He's like, okay, but the thing with Carpenter was, I feel like Carpenter was always experimenting. I mean, that was what was great about Carpenter. You know, Carpenter, he invented the slasher movie. He, with Halloween.
Oh, there's a lot of Giallo fans that are screaming at the radio.
No. The thing is what he did was he took Giallo and he took Giallo and made it accessible to everyone else. Mm-hmm. But he created the slasher genre. Giallo is separate from slasher. Slasher turned into supernatural, you know, murderers, which is not what Giallo was.
No. No, that's not necessarily true. That's the other thing too, is that
evolved into.
If you take Giallo out of the equation, then I'm just going to say Bob Clark fans are screaming at you right now.
The thing is he made the first hit.
Okay.
And he set off the fire, you know, when you look at, cuz what
it was
really,
a watershed movie. I'm not going to
really,
disagree with
what
that.
What really caused the explosion there was Friday the 13th and how much money Friday the 13th made, and Friday the 13th was just ripping off Halloween.
Yeah.
And Halloween was inspired by Giallo and definitely what Bob Clark had done and that work. It is not the first, but it is what invented the slasher genre as a genre. Because I feel like Giallo and slasher are two separate genres, with it playing with a lot of the same things.
Right, but you can't have one without the other. You cannot have the slasher film without the Giallo.
But so he, you know, so he did. So we've got Halloween, and you know, then we get, Escape from New York, and The Thing, and The Fog, and he's just on a roll, and he's just mm-hmm. and Christine, and he's just cranking out these movies that are connecting with everybody. He's doing this amazing work with it, and then he gets into his weirder part of the career where he really is like, okay, I'm going to step out of this box of, you know, slightly experimental things mm-hmm. and go really experimental.
Well, like even with The Thing, for some reason, the fan reaction wasn't, I mean, like the way it's regarded today was not the way it was regarded when it came out. It won Razzies, for God's sake.
It was a remake, you know.
That's true.
And it was a remake.
Thing from Another World.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was a remake that came out a week too late. And it really, I mean, the problem with The Thing and the reaction to The Thing was that critics had just watched E.T. the week before, and they were like, the era of scary aliens is over. We saw Alien, and then we saw the Alien knockoff films, and this is the last Alien knockoff film, and nobody wants scary aliens anymore.
And it would be 4 years until we got Aliens, which kind of brought it back. I was like, oh, no, yeah. Never mind. We're not done with scary aliens.
Yeah, but even then, that wasn't a horror movie. That was an action film. Yeah. And we got back into, I mean, scary aliens never left, but critics had abandoned scary aliens, and they were like, we're done. It's time to turn around.
They just took human form.
They rejected it, and so did audiences. And people didn't want to go see a scary alien film. They wanted to line up around the fucking movie theater, as we did, to see a warm, fuzzy movie about a boy and his dog. The dog just happens to be an alien.
Yeah.
But so, you know, this was... He was always doing experimental stuff. He was always playing around, you know.
I still don't believe...
What I was meaning with Halloween was, you know, that was not a surefire thing in the way that you'd look at now. Like now, if you said, oh, I'm going to make a movie about a mass killer going around killing people, that's...
No, I mean, there's a lot of reasons that that wasn't a surefire thing. I mean, one of which being that up until that point, largely in horror films... The terror was not something that had invaded suburbia yet.
Yeah.
And so, like, no. And the fact that it was an independent film, the fact that they were shooting a movie about the Midwest in the fall, in the spring in California, like, yeah, there was a lot of things about that movie that shouldn't work. So, no, I don't feel like it was a surefire thing. But I do feel like this period of time in Carpenter's career is when he got the most bold, the most creative, and the most experimental.
Yeah.
And it movies like Big Trouble Little China absolutely are the epitome of that.
He made his weirdest films.
He made his weirdest films,
and
absolutely.
And that's exactly what – I mean, that's the thing where you know, you look at Prince of Darkness, mm-hmm. and Prince of Darkness is the second film in what is essentially his Apocalypse trilogy. And it is at heart – a science fiction movie.
Mm-hmm. It seeks to take the oldest religious boogeyman and make it something of a scientific nature.
And it's a brilliantly constructed science fiction film. When you get to mm-hmm. the end of the movie and you realize what that movie's about, it's like, holy shit, that's fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
That's crazy. It's deep, heady stuff. And again, it didn't totally connect with audiences.
No.
But this film, this is easily of those films, of his crazier, I can't believe he got the money to make that movies, this is the best one.
I agree. And, you know, it's, you know, interesting, we talked about Scary Aliens and we talked about The Thing. And I want to talk about the monsters in this movie. You have, you know, you got the three, and the villains as well. You got the three Storms, all of one of whom has the ability to blow himself up in a way that would, like, make David Cronenberg get an erection. Like, I love that scene where the guy just, like, inflates to massive size and just blows up. You've also got the Chinese Sasquatch. You've got the flying eyeball
The Beholder.
Ball. The what?
It's the Beholder. Beholder. It's essentially, it's a version of the Beholder monster.
Right. You know, I mean, it's a lot of this is borrowing from actual Chinese myth. And then, of course, there's the monster in the catacombs that just is like, it's just like a snake in a hole that comes out and eats people.
It looks like one of those fish from the deep sea.
Yes.
It looks like, a fish that exists in the 1,500 feet below sea level.
Right. Absolutely. And then they're all created by Richard Edelman, who was sort of the special effects supervisor on this film, who also worked on movies like Star Wars, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Poltergeist, Fright Night, Ghostbusters, like
just a couple of things.
Just a couple of things you might have heard of. Like, and that's where I think this movie really gets its pulse, is from these like really fantastical creatures and these really sort of bizarre villains. I mean, David Lopan himself, James Hong playing just such an amazing and weird and wonderful, like at any given point in the movie, he is this, this sorcerer, or he's a homeless man, or he's a really aging businessman, like just all of these various forms, and each one requiring such specific makeup and such specific performance from Hong. And I just think that's where the movie really, like all of its fantastical elements are done so well and with such care, that when you add the comedy stuff on top of it, it creates such an interesting sort of, I think we talked about it before, like a goulash of different genres.
Yeah.
And I just, that's one of the things that draws me in with this movie.
Yeah. And the thing about it, that segues nicely into something else I wanted to talk about, which is all of those elements you're talking about, except for one, mm-hmm. really work.
Okay.
And then there's Chinese Sasquatch.
You don't like Chinese Sasquatch?
It's non sequitur in the movie. Like it really,
yeah,
like everything else has an explanation and ties in, and Chinese Sasquatch is just kind of like, he's just there. And it's like, he had this really cool creature design that they wanted to use and they had no place for it. So they have an establishing shot where we see him kind of show up down there, and then he doesn't do a whole lot until the final gag of the movie.
Yeah. But I feel like the ancient fish in the wall is exactly the same way.
Well, that whole sequence, when I talked about the two things that I think, you know, this is a near perfect script,
mm-hmm.
the two problems with the film are Chinese Sasquatch, which doesn't make a whole hell of a lot of sense. And then every scene where they're underground walking, doing the long underground trudge to the underground, the escalator, the neon escalator temple of the skull, which is the most 80s thing ever.
The Lopan Galleria.
There is no scene in cinema history in which the set is more 80s than the wedding chapel of Lopan. And
attention, Lopan shoppers, there is a sale on fake green contacts at Dr. Tavlon level 2.
Absurd, but it's part of the magic of it. There's an absurdity to that particular set design that's just like, this is so 80s, it's amazing. like, it's just a bit like, it's an escalator coming out of the mouth of a skull, wreathed in green neon, fuck yes. Throw in a guy with a mullet in, you know, a muscle shirt, and you've got the 80s, oh, hey, look.
Yeah.
But that whole sequence of them down below, doesn't really do anything except buffer time. And it really is, it's one of those things that people run into with the second act, third act problems. And where I was, you know, where we've talked before about Monomyth, here is that section of the Monomyth that is part of the quest. And it feels they're adding a little extra magic to this, but in a sequence we really don't need. If you cut out Chinese
Sasquatch
and you cut out the sequence of them down below, the only thing you lose is mentioning the potion.
I don't understand why you're trying to kill Chinese Sasquatch. I mean, to quote the great philosopher Rocket Raccoon, it's like you're just trying to suck the joy out of everything.
Yeah, no, it's no. It's in terms of perfection of writing, the thing is in any other movie, I wouldn't even think twice about it. But every other element of this film is so carefully crafted. So every setup is paid off. Nothing is left dangling. Everything pays off in the best way. And it's such a satisfying movie, right down to the perfection, the absolute perfection of the final sequence, the final scene with Jack Burton and his friends, in which Kim Cattrall is leaning up against the post seductively. He spent the whole movie trying to seduce her.
Aren't you going
to
kiss her goodbye?
Nope. And it's just, it's like in that moment, it's like, yes, this is Jack Burton. And this is why nothing ever totally works out for Jack Burton, because he really is an asshole, but he's our asshole, to quote Die Hard 2. And that is such a perfect scene. It's just like, oh, yes, because the audience wants him to kiss her deeply. And no, he's not, because you know what? That's not what that, you know what old Jack Burton always says? Nope. But everything in that script is so carefully constructed that a monster coming out of nowhere and then kind of the wandering, you know, the wandering quest scene, both kind of feel out of place in what is otherwise a spot on flawless script.
I'm going to disagree, only in so much as that the entire movie is, you know, supposed to be seen through Jack Burton's eyes. That's the whole premise of the film, is that we are experiencing things through Burton, and, you know, a stranger in a strange land kind of situation. So pretty much every single creature, every single villain, everything is going to come out of nowhere for Jack Burton. Now, more literally translated, yes, fish monster from the wall does in fact come out of nowhere. That is specifically what he does, but I don't feel like either one of those things takes away from the perfection of the screenplay, because the screenplay itself is supposed to be the entire story as viewed through the eyes of Jack Burton, the outsider, so that it, you know, so that we feel even more out of place. It's kind of the same way with, you know, a movie we're going to talk about next week. I don't even know why I brought that up. I will save that for next week. But I do want to talk about the music in this film, and you can't talk about a John Carpenter film without talking about the score, because
John Carpenter.
Because John Carpenter does the score. And in this case, John Carpenter, I think this may be his best overall score, as far as a score that really kind of gives life to a movie, because it's still very synthesized as per Carpenter form, but it has so much more energy and life than his previous scores. Like, it really is electric. And I love, like, at the opening where you just see you hear the faintest of an overture start to rise as Egg Shin is finishing his story, and sort of that Rambo-like scene, like where Egg Shin is basically Colonel Troutman, like, you don't understand Jack Burton, you don't understand what he's been through. Leave that man alone. And then all of a sudden it starts to rise over the hill and you see the truck coming, and it's just so goddamn perfect. Like, it gets you so excited.
Oh, that shot is so... I mean, the thing is that's one of the things about Carpenter, is he, for his era, he just knew how to shoot things that just... It looked cinematic. It looked big.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, he chose just the right lenses and framed it just the right way to where the, you know...
Well, credit there to Cundy as well.
Yeah, but the when that truck just comes roaring over the hill to that score, you're like, fuck yeah, this movie fucking rocks. I'm in it. I'm ready. Let's go. Fuck yes.
Absolutely.
And you know, the Egg Shen scene is kind of weird, and never explained, but perfectly so. It's a perfect opening to understanding, you know, the story we're told.
I'm pretty sure that's actually the scene that 20th Century Fox made him put in. There was mention made when I was doing my research of the quote unquote opening scene that John Carpenter didn't necessarily feel was necessary. And it was unclear to me when I was doing my research. I didn't bring it up because it was unclear whether they meant the scene with Egg Shen or the scene of Jack Burton on his CB radio, just kind of spouting off his own personal Taoism. But I think they might have been referring actually to the egg, because you're right. There's no,
they don't pay that off later.
There's no government interaction at all or interference at all throughout the whole movie.
No, the cops show up at the very end, and we don't even really see the explosion of green flame that were promised, the half a city block being destroyed.
Maybe it's like the octopus line at the end of the Goonies where Data says the octopus was the scariest part, and you're like, what octopus? And then you realize that was a deleted scene.
That was a deleted scene.
And they just left that line in.
Yeah, but the thing is as much as weird as that is, it actually fills in a lot of blanks for us, which is one of the reasons I love that scene. Mm-hmm. I don't think that scene is a non sequitur, and I'm surprised that it was something. Is it essential? No, but it sure fills in a lot of the holes. And I think the studio, if that was the scene they put in, they made the right call, because that is one of those things where that scene really, it sets the mood for what you're about to watch.
Yeah.
So when that truck roars over the hill, you're ready. You're just like, fuck yes. And it does fill in the blanks of kind of what happens after the fact. Like, because there's that whole kind of question after a lot of these kinds of films of like, well, how the fuck do you explain that to everybody? And
so we're just never going to talk about this again, world? Okay.
Yeah. So instead you have kind of that Ghostbusters moment of Walter Peck
coming in and being like, I need you to shut down the system.
Yeah.
You didn't say the magic word.
But it's
true. This man has no dick. I'm sorry. Now I'm just doing Ghostbusters.
We're going to do Ghostbusters lines now. And that's the end of the show, mm-hmm. folks. Thanks for coming by. so now I've completely been derailed. That said, I will keep talking anyway.
Well,
I have beer.
because that's what happens on this show.
Yeah, but that opening sequence, I think it really works for what it does and sets up, explains what everything that comes together at the end. But everything else in the script is so perfectly put together. Mm-hmm. That's just why, going back to what we were talking about earlier, that's why those two scenes kind of feel out of place for me, because
the Chinese Sasquatch just sticking in your craw.
It does. It does. I mean, I do enjoy the
payoff. Which is the weirdest sentence I have ever spoken out loud.
No, it's really not. It's not even the weirdest sentence you've said on this fucking show.
I don't know. I think it's up there, but I will have to go back and listen.
No.
But you know what? As far as the music goes, that song at the end of the movie.
Big Trouble.
Yeah, that one. So that was composed by the rock group Coupe de Ville. Why haven't you heard of this band? Because it was composed of John Carpenter, Tommy Lee Wallace, who was Carpenter's longtime production designer and actually directed Halloween 3, and Nick Castle, who played Michael Myers in the original Halloween, or as he was referred to in the script, The Shape.
And also wrote a little movie called Skate Town USA.
That is true, and there is nothing we can do about it. It just happened. We had to sit there and he also directed a film called Last Starfighter. So
yeah, a little movie.
Little movie called Last Starfighter, guys. Pretty much justifies all the video game playing we do. I'm just saying. Next time your mom tells you to stop playing so many video games, be like, I'm just trying to protect the universe. Maybe get off my back.
You know they're making that movie.
What? Really? They're doing a remake?
No. No, they're making a movie about a massive alien invasion, and so for some reason the way the code's written, you have to they need classic video gamers to fight these aliens.
That's just Last Starfighter. You've just all right, yeah. Fine.
Well, I'm gonna make you really interested in it, and then I'm gonna make you uninterested in it. You
go.
One of the classic 80s arcade gamers happens to play a little guy named Tyrion on Game of Thrones.
Dinklage points.
Dinklage points. Very interested. The movie is written by and stars Adam Sandler and James. What's his name? Was always in all of Adam Sandler's movies. King of Queens.
Okay.
Yeah. See how you got really excited there for half a second, and then you stopped being excited.
So much like Buckaroo Banzai, Big Trouble Little China is a film that was a box office bomb, but earned a cult following later on. What isn't clear, though, is the reason for why it was such a bomb. I mean, one source I read actually said that Carpenter blamed Fox for not putting enough into marketing it, which is something that can happen. If a movie's not marketed very well, people don't know it exists, you know, that can happen. However, during the commentary on the DVD, if you listen to that, he talks about how he kind of found they had like a basically an edict on paper that said they had to spend at least $3 million on advertising for any movie that they did. And he thought that was a little bit of an absurd figure. And they're like, we're going to put up all these big billboards and blah, blah, blah. And he was kind of like, okay, that seems a little foolish, but yeah, go ahead and do it. And apparently they got so overzealous about it that they rushed this artwork into production for these billboards. And Kurt Russell talks about how he didn't even like it didn't even look like him in the billboards. And some of the artwork, like if you look at like the Asian posters for Big Trouble in Little China, it does not look like Kurt Russell in the slightest. Like at all does it look like Kurt Russell. So I don't think it really was a case of marketing, because I feel like they threw a lot of money behind the marketing. Probably wasn't great marketing. Obviously, the artwork wasn't very good, but I don't think you can say. I don't mean that to say that the actual poster for the film isn't good, because I believe it's a Drew Struzan, and Struzan is the man. I'm talking about like the billboards and stuff that they put out, but it's just weird. It's a film that I think there was a little too much going on. I feel like there was a lot of genres that at the time were, you know, the kind of things enjoyed by very niche audiences and not the mainstream. I'm glad that, you know, it's gotten the appreciation that it has. And going back to the question, is it too big for this show? I don't think so.
The theory I've always kind of run with, and I'm not entirely sold on it, but it comes at a very weird point in the 80s, and it comes at a point that I think we're headed towards. And
headed back to the 80s?
We're in the 80s. Oh. I mean, this is cinematically speaking, we are dead on in the 80s. We are.
Oh, we got to go back.
I have a feeling that we're like right in kind of the 1984 era of it. But the thing is, you know,
I'm going to get reborn.
Yeah. The thing is, and this is how, now this part I'm sure of, you know, audiences work in cycles, and the pendulum swings back and forth between fantasy and realism. And in the 80s, we had this, you know, hardcore love of fantasy that had been born from so many of these great, huge hit movies. And it was all fantasy all the time. And there are some great bits of realism in there. You have, you know, your ordinary people, you have your The Natural, but you have your Out of Africa. But the realism wasn't what that was all about. And then the pendulum started to swing back, and the alpha film goers were tired of genre. And they're like, I'm kind of sick of this. I'm kind of tired of just shit blowing up and being jokey and goofy. And I kind of want something a little fresher, and I want something real. And this has been happening, in genre for over 100 years, you know. 100 years ago, Edgar Rice Burroughs was, you know, one of the biggest writers in the country, was churning out all this great genre. You know, he was writing Tarzan, he was writing John Carter of Mars, it was really huge. And then people kind of got fatigued with it, and then they swung over, and we had the Lost Generation. And suddenly it was all about realism, and it was all about real life. And then in the 30s, we had this throwback again to pulp. And then we had this throwback again to realism, and then pulp, and then realism, and fantasy, and realism. And right now, we're deep in the fantasy, and we are in the fantastic. And we just had audiences go out, and as we've talked about a couple of times, and we'll probably continue to talk about for a few weeks, Guardians of the Galaxy embraced it, was like, fuck yeah, talking raccoon, a giant tree that only has one word that can be understood as different things. I'm fucking in it. And then eventually what's going to happen is you're going to have the audiences get a bit fatigued, and they're going to want to go back and see something indie and darker and more raw and real. And Big Trouble in Little China was that film that was sitting right there on the bubble before our genre became much more grounded action films. You know, the year after this came out, we got Die Hard. Mm-hmm. And that became the model of the kind of big budget, you know, mainstream popcorn that we saw. And people moved away from wanting to see mainly fantasy. Even our fantasy was dark and gritty, like Terminator 2, which was, you know, you know, hardcore science fiction.
The Matrix.
Well, The Matrix came in 99.
No, but I'm saying, like, if we're talking about a pendulum swinging from the 80s to the 90s, and I do agree that there was a large shift away from fantasy into realism, but even the most fantastical stuff of the 90s, you know, you talk about movies like Terminator 2 and The Matrix. Yeah. The Matrix is dystopia.
Yeah.
Like, it's science fiction dystopia. It's Orwellian, to say the least.
And it's when you look at the films of the 90s, you know, the very best films of the 90s are entrenched in realism. They're Shawshank Redemption, they're Pulp Fiction. They're, even when they're playing with classic genres, they are grounding them in realism so that we can, you know, you Boogie Nights. You know, these are films.
So by classic genres, you mean porn?
No. Forrest Gump, which was one of the biggest hits of the time, which is essentially a fantasy. But Drew McWeeny refers to it, a mean-spirited cinematic hate crime. It is a...
Oh, Drew.
Yeah, oh, Drew. But it's one of my favorite quotes in history from a critic. If you've never read Drew McWeeny's review of Forrest Gump, you need to seek that out, because it is a thing of beauty and of actually wonderful criticism, whether you agree with them or not. But no, you know, the 90s were grounded in realism, and then we saw that realism bleed over into the first half of the 2000s before we really swung heavy into fantasy, and fantasy became what it's all about, and that's where we are right now. And this really was, if you look at it, 86 is that year that everyone was, it was kind of, we still had some bleed over of genre, but nobody was really going hard genre anymore, and they wanted something different. And then that next year we started getting really good raw realism and had realism for several years. We had big budget realism and until the indie wave came, and that's why we embraced the indie wave, and we wanted something low budget and raw. And I feel like we are right there again, and I feel like we're going to have that movie that us alpha film goers, us hardcore film geeks, the type of people who sit around listening to two douchebags, you know, banter on about movies you've already watched 100 times.
Why would you do that?
Why would you do that? You guys, eventually you're going to hit that point where there's going to be a movie where we're going to love it, but audiences are going to be kind of like, I'm just not into it. I'm looking for something else. And we're going to be at the same time already looking for something else. And mm-hmm. and eventually we're going to lead the way to whatever the next thing is. And I say by we, I don't mean us. I mean we as you know, alpha film goers. Somebody's going to find something amazing that we're going to be like, yes, this is new and fresh and different. And I feel like that's what really, really kind of bogged down this film, is this film just came 2 years too late. Had Carpenter made this film in 84, I think this would have probably hit along with Ghostbusters. Mm-hmm. But instead it was after the fact. It was just kind of like, more of this. I kind of want something different.
And
of course, this is the era where Schwarzenegger and Stallone took over as action heroes. And it wasn't about Kurt Russell anymore. It was about muscles.
It was about Marion goddamn Cobretti. That's what it was about.
You're goddamn right.
Which actually came out the same year as Big Trouble in Little China, just for a nice little end note on that entire theory. Hey, speaking of theories, so we started this month-long series of sci-fi comedies because of how much I thoroughly love the shit out of Guardians of the Galaxy. I have now seen it 3 times. And many people were talking about, I read this again and again and again, how Guardians brought to the screen an energy and specific type of space opera that we hadn't seen since Star Wars. And while I don't disagree with that, the movie that Guardians kept reminding me of as I was watching it was Big Trouble in Little China. I mean, you have a hapless, overly macho hero who fails upward in the direction of heroism in both Jack Burton and Star-Lord. You have these heroes who fumble their way into a long-standing mystical conflict, and in both cases, the entry point revolves around trying to obtain illicit profits, whether it's gambling money or making money selling the artifact that he totally steals, Raiders of the Lost Ark style, at the beginning of Guardians. And not only that, but like the relationship between Jack Burton and Dennis Don Wang isn't terribly dissimilar from that of Star-Lord and Gamora, where she, with her martial arts and knowledge of the actual mystical realm they're engaged in, is the real hero, and Star-Lord is sort of the Burton-esque buffoon. It's also very similar in its specific balance of action, fantasy, and comedy. So the whole time I'm watching Guardians of the Galaxy, I can't help but think about Big Trouble in Little China, which I think, as I said last week with Buckaroo Banzai, you know, there are moments in Guardians where I'm just sitting there and I'm just so happy that the movie exists, to be able to live in a world where this movie exists. And that's, again, that's the same situation I have watching Big Trouble in Little China.
Well, James Gunn is an experimental director and writer, to say the least. I mean, he took a lot of licks from the community back in the day, because he was, for a while, best known as the writer of the Scooby-Doo movies.
That's very true.
No, he was.
I know that.
I mean, I've been a guy who's been in with James Gunn's career for a long time and riding this roller coaster. And this is the most James Gunn film he's ever made. But I've been right there, you know, in his days at Troma when he was a writer for...
Which is why Lloyd Kaufman, by the way, has a cameo in the prison in Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah,
Lloyd Kaufman is in space prison. No, and this is very much a movie from the Kaufman school in which... Gunn throws all of his fucking friends into this goddamn movie. Like, you can't, there's hardly a frame of this film where if James Gunn isn't in frame, one of his friends is. I mean, it's just, they're all over the place. But you know, he went from Troma and got into big budget screenwriting, and then wrote a bunch of, you know, wrote the Scooby-Doo films and worked on a bunch of stuff, and then went off to become a director, and then did something weird with Slither. And then Slither didn't hit, and then finally got to make another movie with Super, which definitely didn't hit, but is really fantastic. And then did PG Porn, which is one of the best viral video series ever put on the internet. If you've never watched PG Porn, James Gunn literally mocks all of the porn that was popular at the time, some of which still is popular. So PG Porn, you know, is this brilliant thing you also need to seek out. And then when he got this, it was just like, how the fuck is he going to make Guardians of the Galaxy? What the fuck is this?
Yeah.
But he's a guy whose DNA is in bizarro fiction and is in this strange kind of, that it's always more about the comedy than it is about the real idea. And all of his work is like that. And honestly, I think, it's closer to PG Porn than anything else he's ever worked on, in that, you know, PG Porn is all about the comedy and not the delivery. You know, it's really more about the joke than it is about getting Guardians of the Galaxy right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very much, I think you're right in feeling, because that's very much what's happening with Big Trouble in Little China. Mm-hmm. Because unlike many of other Carpenter's films, Carpenter's films are often about these big ideas and these carefully constructed, you know, plots. And this is very much, plot-wise, it's very simple. It's very mm-hmm. down-to-earth, very much like Guardians of the Galaxy, where it's just like, yeah, there's these bad guys and here are the good guys, and we're going to watch the good guys kind of bumble their way through trouble until they beat the bad guy. But it's about the journey and the hilarity of that journey, as opposed to the actual construction of the plot, right, which in both cases is incredibly simplistic, but very effective, because we care about these characters and because these characters are very funny and all the jokes work. And yeah, I definitely see, I see Big Trouble's DNA and fingerprints all over Guardians.
Absolutely. And if nothing else, this movie has made my autograph picture of James Hong one of my most prized possessions. Getting to meet him, and I'm not, like, I live in Austin, so I've been spoiled. I've never been down for the, like, meeting a celebrity and paying for an autograph like they do at conventions.
Yeah.
But they did a thing at the Alamo where he was charging for autographs because he was trying to get a film funded. He's still making movies. He's getting way up there in age. I think he's in his 80s.
Like Teen Lust.
Yeah, he's making a movie called, yeah.
He directed a film in the 70s, which is...
Well, his new movie isn't terribly dissimilar from that. That's why I laughed. But so I was like, yeah, I'll give him $15 for an autograph and help, you know, help support the guy and help his movie get made. And he signed the portrait of him as Lopan, and just, he asked my name and just wrote, Brian Indeed. And I was just like, okay, that is awesome. Thank you, Lopan. Thank you, Big Trouble in Little China, for being an amazing piece of cinema.
Now, this really pisses me off to no end.
And that brings us, of course, to the junk food pairing. Now, when I was a kid, no joke, No, there's no joke at all, actually. There was a Chinese buffet in our neighborhood called the Little China Buffet. And I, as a kid, was a very picky eater. I still am in a lot of ways. And I would not eat Chinese food at all.
Yeah, yeah. Just try to get a vegetable near this guy.
Yeah, no,
anywhere near this guy.
Not going to happen. But I liked going to that buffet because it was the kind of buffet that had things like spaghetti, corn dogs, and tacos on a Chinese buffet.
Oh, yeah. The good old-fashioned Chinese super buffet.
Yeah.
We have one of those in town.
Every town has one. But I specifically remember this one and the fact that it was called the Little China Buffet and the fact that it had all of these incongruous things given the fact that it was, in fact, a Chinese buffet just feels so perfect as the junk food pairing for this actual film that has all these elements that don't really go together whatsoever, that cannot be categorized in the same, like if you had.
And has probably been sitting on the buffet so long during the day that after you eat that stuff combined, you will have big trouble in Little China.
Boom. Look at that. See how we brought it full circle? Well, that's going to do it for this week's show.
Told her there was a joke.
You brought the joke out. That wasn't me. But yeah, I want to remind you guys once again, we are on iTunes. We're on Stitcher. You can follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. And Cargill, where can people find you online?
On twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at facebook.com/C. Robert Cargill. You can also find my books, Queen of the Dark Things and Dreams and Shadows, wherever you buy books. And if you're anywhere in the Chicago area right now, we should be shooting Sinister 2. So Sinister 2 will be in theaters next August.
See, I thought you were going to go there for the Ghost Dad slash Fit conviction, but apparently slash Fit
convention. Oh, no, it's not so much a convention as the three of us get together at a coffee shop.
Oh, it's more of a circle jerk. I got you. Well, you can find me online on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury, on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisbury, or you can find me over at my other home, oneofus.net, doing podcasts, writing articles, you know, basic
making
geeky
movies,
stuff.
Making songs,
and fighting around the world. All right, well, there you have it. So for Cargo, this is Brian reminding you that evil spirits make a big scene in little spiritual state.
What does that mean?
I don't know. I think it has something to do with Hot Pockets.